I'm Stefan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm happy to be here. Billy, thanks for asking me. It's always a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for lack of a better term, or the life I have today, which is a life. What was going on before I got sober, I mean, you could loosely classify as a life, but that would be a stretch, you know what I mean? It'd be a real stretch. Or it wasn't a life that anybody really wanted, I'll say that. So, you know, I'm happy to do anything that I can to, you know, repay the debt that I owe. So I hope I always feel that way. You know, that's what I've been taught, so I'm happy to do it. But I've been sober since January 10th of 2011. I have a home group. It's called the Midtown Group Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets on 7:30 on Sunday nights in Bethesda, Maryland. And I have a sponsor. I try to allow myself to be actively sponsored, and I have the privilege of sponsoring other men. It's good to be here, man. I like, you know, I'm an alcoholic and, you know, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say this a lot, you know, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I was telling Billy actually before the meeting, I take a meeting into this hospital in Maryland, and it's a grab bag. You know, there's some alcoholics, and it's a behavioral ward, so you never really know what you're going to get. So a lot of the time I kind of have to explain what Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know what I mean, and what I'm doing there and blah, blah, blah. And I always kind of say, you know, I don't have any problem with alcohol. I'm not here as, you know, I'm not here to badmouth alcohol, man. If anything, I'm a big supporter, you know what I mean? I'm actually a big fan of what alcohol is doing, you know what I mean? I think it has a pretty quality purpose out there. You know, if alcohol was a stock, I'd put like a lot of money in that stock real early. So I'm a big investor in what's going on. And alcohol, you know, for lack of a better term, kept me, I'll say alive, but it kept me like sane long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. Or the real weird way to put it is, it kept me sane long enough to go completely insane and then come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? You know, and what I mean by that is, like, well, I'll say this. I go to, you know, if you've ever been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous before, you've probably been in a meeting where someone spoke or talked about the way they felt before they ever took a drink of alcohol. And you know, most of the time I hear people talk about, you know, they felt weird or different or uncomfortable or just, you know, can never quite feel okay in their own skin or never felt like as happy as other people looked. And I was not self-aware enough. You know, my first drink was when I was 12. So we're talking about like an 11-year-old kid. I had no idea what was going on. You know what I mean? I knew I liked baseball, setting things on fire, and I had a pretty sweet orange Huffy bicycle. And that was like all I knew about in life, and that was enough. But in retrospect, like looking back now and really thinking about it, I can tell you that I always felt like the simple way to put it is I would have told you that life was generally pretty lame. Like life was just a mildly dissatisfying experience in general. Like all the hype about being alive and living was like pretty overrated in my opinion, you know? It always seemed like I was incapable of getting the level of like satisfaction or happiness out of life that it looked like other people got. We could do the same thing. We could live identical lives, have, you know, play the same sports, do just as well in school, have the same family. You know, I could get, you know, the girlfriend that I thought, any of those things, they could all happen, and I would never get just that sense of like, like I got what I needed to feel okay, we're good. And it looked like other people got that out of life. I don't know if they did, but at least I felt like that's how it looked. And I just, what I know now is like, I never got total relief and peace and ease, right? And the first time that ever was not true, and I felt what it meant to be like wholly satisfied or at just total peace and ease was the first time I got like a real good drunk, like a real good drunk in me. And that was when I was 12 years old, like I said, in pretty standard suburban kid drunk world, which means in the basement of my friend's house with like a handle of, it was clear liquor. I'm assuming it was vodka now in retrospect, although at the time I didn't know, that someone had swiped from their old man. And we were at my friend's house who had the walkout basement, who's like the best friend when you're in like high school and late middle school, because you drink down there and you're like, we're sleeping down here, and then you just leave, you know? It was the best. So that's what we did. It was two or three of us, you know, we drank as much as, you know, three guys with a combined weight of like, you know, 200 pounds could drink out of a handle of vodka. And I was a blackout drinker from Jump Street, blacked out that night. I remember bits and pieces, but no, like, you know, I was a blackout drinker my whole drinking career. So, but that night I remember, you know, getting good and drunk, going out, walking out the walkout basement, walking around the neighborhood, and kicking over mailboxes, which was like a pastime that we used to do, which is the worst. And now I'm a homeowner. If someone kicked over my mailbox, I'd be furious, because that seems like such a task. You know, it's like, oh my God, I have to repair this whole mailbox? I hate you. But I was that guy. So we would like kick over a mailbox, then, you know, go into a dead sprint down the street because you're convinced someone's chasing you, although no one's really ever chasing you, but you're convinced of it. And I remember, like, I have a memory in retrospect now of being in, like, that good, dead sprint. Well, if you've ever been in, like, a really good run while hammered drunk, there's, like, a 10-second window where you feel amazing. You know what I mean? You just feel, like, more free than you've ever felt in your whole life. It's followed by feeling more sick than you've ever felt in your entire life. But for that 10 seconds, like, I felt, like, more, like, in retrospect, at the time, I was 12. So if you asked me the next day, I just would have been like, it was awesome. You know what I mean? That's the extent of my descriptive ability at 12. Awesome. But now I can look back and tell you, like, what I had experienced that night was, like, complete relief, you know, total peace and ease. Like, it was the first time that I felt as good as I thought everybody looked like they felt. And it was the first time that like, glaze of dissatisfaction that, like, laid over everything else in life, like, seemed to go away. I didn't know any of this at the time. This is all in retrospect, you know. Having come and been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while, I can look back and you know, have, like, an objective view of what happened. But, you know, today, having been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you that feeling of dissatisfaction and that life is always just kind of lame, what that is it's a spiritual malady, right? That's what the book describes it as. It's a spiritual malady. I have a spiritual sickness. And there's only two things I've ever found that offer real, true relief to that spiritual sickness. One is a good drunk, you know, and the other is working 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's it. I tried a lot of other weird stuff in between, which we'll get into, because I got an hour, so I can get weird with it. But for me, like, that is a characteristic specific to alcoholics. You know what I mean? Like, my brother is about as almost frighteningly normal, frustratingly normal for most of my life, you know? I have a frustratingly normal brother. And he's, like, my best friend today, but for a while it was annoying. But he, like, will drink. He drinks, you know what I mean? And sometimes he drinks to get drunk, and sometimes he gets drunk and does dumb things. That's not specific to alcoholics. We tend to have better stories, but he can do all that. But I feel pretty confident when I say that drinking isn't the only way for him to get that feeling of relief. You know what I mean? I feel like he does it for other reasons that I don't know, because I'm not a non-alcoholic, but I feel pretty confident when I say that he doesn't drink because it's the only chance he has to feel, like, totally okay. So that was, you know, that first drunk, like I said, was when I was 12. I didn't wake up the next day and, like, roll over for the bottle, you know what I mean, and drink it and then be like, I guess I live under a bridge now, and, like, go live under a bridge. I was 12, so all I thought was, that was fun. I want to do it again, you know what I mean? I'd like to do it as often as I can. You know, when you're 12 and 13, you know, for me, that was, like, the summer before high school, so then I was in high school, and as often as I can. It was originally like on the weekends, you know what I mean? Get drunk every weekend for the most part. And looking back now, I can say that I almost immediately did start to change small parts of my life to fit alcohol in. You know what I mean? I started to, you know, there were different posters in my room than there were before. I listened to different music. I slowly started to veer towards different friends. You know what I mean? The friends who I had who didn't want to drink on the weekends, I saw less at first by default, and then next because I knew hanging out with them was not going to offer the relief that I needed at any point. So I can say that, like, you know, I didn't, immediately devolve into, you know, the type of alcoholic life I would get into later, but I did start to make some changes in my life to allow more room for alcohol, really. And so I, you know, for the most part through high school, I was able to sort of, you know, maintain for the most part. And most of it I was just trying to maintain for appearance sake, you know what I mean? I was living at home with my parents, like they were on my back less if I, like, maintained this, like, you know, at least on the outside it looked like I had it together, trying to do okay in school and blah, blah, blah. Although I will say I was terrible at, like, hiding what I was doing. You know, I got caught drinking and doing other stuff every weekend. You know what I mean? I have physically vomited on my parents on multiple occasions, which I don't know if that's normal or not, but it happened many times. You know what I mean? I've literally, like, vomited on my mom and then argued that I was not drunk, which is a terrible start to the argument. You always lose that argument. So, you know, in high school, you know, I didn't really experience, other than, like, just getting caught and stuff like that, which seemed par for the course, you know what I mean? Getting in trouble, you get grounded, so you sneak out or you lie more than I was already lying. That was par for the course. So there weren't any true real consequences, at least that I thought I experienced. When I look back now, I can tell you that I started to give up things that had previously been important to me because they were no longer as important to me as alcohol was. You know, I played soccer in high school. And before my senior year, you know, it was like the end of the summer. So you start practice, you know, like at the end of the summer. And that's like the intense practice time. And I remember the night before, my friend called me and was like, hey, I'll pick you up 7 a.m. or whatever for practice. And I was out drinking, and I was like, nah, don't bother. And he was like, what do you mean you're not going tomorrow? I was like, nah, I think I'm just going to quit. You know, it was that easy, you know. And, you know, soccer wasn't like, I'm not going to stand up here and pretend like I had, like, some deep-seated passion for it. And I can't tell you how many meetings I go to where people are like, yeah, and I could have been something. You know, I could not have been a professional soccer player. You know what I mean? If you believed everyone in a meeting who told you they could have been a professional sports player, you've been in meetings with, like, thousands of professional athletes. So I, like, it's not so much that, but the ease with which I was willing to give it up in retrospect is, like, so indicative of, you know, what was really important to me. Because, you know, I wouldn't have told you, you know, if you asked me at the time and said, what's more important to you, playing soccer or drinking, I wouldn't have told you outright drinking. You know what I mean? I just, not even so much because I knew that doesn't sound good, but just because I wasn't aware of it, you know? Because these things that I was willing to give up and would later, you know, the things I would give up later in life would get far worse. This is just an early test case. But, you know, the test case is just that, you know, these things are important to me. And when I tell you they're important to me, like soccer, family, all these things, I mean it. They are important to me until they're put in direct competition with alcohol. Because everything, when in direct competition of choosing A or B, always loses to alcohol. Because as much as I love soccer or my family or anything like that, you know, I know that that's not going to offer the relief that this is. You know what I mean? So when it really boils down to the moment, you know what I mean, where I got to, like, make the call, you know, like, am I going to go to my brother's birthday or am I going to go with my friends who have, like, a fifth of whiskey? It's like, oh, I'm going with my friends 100 out of 100 times. You know what I mean? Doesn't mean I didn't really want to go there or didn't think I should. Doesn't matter, you know. And that's a hard thing to explain to a non-alcoholic, you know what I mean? Because, like, all my mom knows is I didn't show up. You know what I mean? All my soccer coach knows is I quit for seemingly no reason. You know what I mean? And so that was, like, just kind of the start. You know what I mean? That was very indicative of how things would get, because then I would leave high school and I went to college and I went to the University of Maryland. And, you know, like I said, that was – so that was when I was finally, like, able to drink the way I wanted to drink, you know. I didn't feel like I had – you know, I wasn't living at home with my folks. I didn't have to keep up these appearances for anybody anymore. I could really just do what I wanted to do. And for me, what that looks like is – by the time I was 21 years old, you know, it was the beginning, I guess, of my junior year, or my third junior year is a, what that's if you're counting credits. My third year in college, beginning of my third year in college, I was living in an apartment with two friends of mine. Although one friend left because one had already had to leave, and I can't remember if he like went to jail or if he went to rehab. But he went somewhere. He wasn't there anymore. So with one remaining friend and then me, and I had pawned everything of value in the apartment. I had a mattress, twin mattress on the floor in the bedroom. No, like, actual bedding. You know, the term bed is loosely used. And then, like, a couch, an old couch. That was gross. And then a box TV that I had found, like, next to a dumpster. This was flat-screen TVs had started to come on now, so box TVs were of no value at the pawn shop, which is why that box TV was still there. I think it was worth like $4 at the pawn shop. So that was, and I was actually not sleeping in my mattress. I had moved in a drug dealer of mine who had gotten evicted because it seemed like an economic decision to move him in because then maybe he'd be indebted to me temporarily. So he slept in my mattress, and I just slept on the floor. And this was my life. You know, this was the state of my life. I was failing out of school. I failed out of one major. Now I was failing out of school in general. I hadn't paid rent at that apartment in I don't know how long. I talked to my family as minimally as humanly possible. The girl who was the one who I dated forever was gone. She had left me long ago. And, you know, I had... Like I said, I already kind of described my one friend situation, and that was a general summary of the people that I was hanging with at that time, and I had pushed almost everyone else out of my life. And if you drink the way I drink, you know, when I'm drinking the way I want to drink and living the way I live, life becomes like a constant state of crisis, you know? Like every day is like a full-time job to, like, keep the house of cards together. You know what I mean? I got to tell this lie to support that lie to support that lie so I can make sure I get this money here or they don't find out about that. You know, it's just a constant house of cards, like, ready to, like, implode at, like, any moment, you know? And my story is that it always all – it's never, like, a series of small catastrophes. They always, like, all happen on the same day. Always. I don't know what it is. It's like everything always happens at the same day. It's like you make one mistake in like your charade and like the dam breaks and all the problems hit at once. So this one day I was living in that apartment still, and I wake up one morning on the floor, drug dealers in the bed. I'm like, terrible hangover. It's hot, you know what I mean? Because I don't think we've paid the electricity bill. It's summer, you know what I mean? It's hot as can be in there. And you know, I got terrible hangovers my whole drinking. I'm, you know, jealous of people who said they didn't, like, but I had terrible hangovers, so I wake up terribly hungover. The night before, I tried to invite that girl up who was the one who I was trying to win back, and it went terribly sour. My roommate, like, projectile vomited on her, so she was gone, like, not coming back at this point. And I wake up, I look out the door, and they're towing my truck, from outside of the building because you needed to pay like $60 to get a parking pass at the building. And if you drink like I drink, if you have $60, you know what I mean? Guess where $60 isn't going? It's not going to the parking pass. So I just been parking at a parking meter out front, not paying the meter for months. Literally, I got a ticket every day for months, plural. I had what ended up being close to $10,000 in parking tickets. And so they towed my car. I remember I ran down, it was an apartment building, so I ran down into the street. I'm like arguing with the tow truck guy, like shirtless, hungover, sweating, which is not a good look for anybody. And he looks at me the way I probably deserve to be looked at, and then just pulled away. And I remember standing there in the middle of the street just like, why? Like everything had happened at once. And it just felt like my whole world was imploding on me, which is the first of many times this would happen. And I remember I went back inside, and I did like what any self-respecting, self-sufficient, grown man does when, you know, life seems to be hitting you on the head and you don't know what to do. And I called my mom. And I said, I basically like in a moment of what I would later think was stupidity, I told her everything. You know what I mean? I was like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I can't stop drinking. You know, I got all this going on. I need some help. So that was like my first experience of like some form of surrender. And so, you know, I went home to my folks' place, and, you know, God bless my parents. You know, they did everything. I'm a parent today, so I can't imagine what it would be like. They did everything they could for me. You know, what they tried to do then was just basically say, stay at the home. We'll basically watch you like a hawk. You know, you live in the basement now, and we'll basically manage everything you do and, you know, try to help you stay sober. And, you know, I thought that would work, too. I was of the opinion that that would work because, you know, what I thought then and for many years, actually, after that, was that I just needed some time. You know what I mean? I just need some time to get it together, which, you know, if you ever talk to someone who's brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's like a classic phrase. It's like, I just need some time to get it together, man. I just need to get my stuff together. I just thought I needed some time put between me and the drink, you know what I mean? Some time to, like, dry out and sober up, and I would be, like, reset to default human mode, you know what I mean? Like, I could admit that I had gotten out of control. Things had gotten bad. It was, like, very clear, a lot of evidence to point to. You know, I understood that, you know, I had been drinking in a way that was not healthy, and I could see all that, you know what I mean? I would acknowledge all of it. In those moments of weakness, I understood that. But I wouldn't have told you I was an alcoholic because I didn't know what an alcoholic was at that point. This is before I'd ever been to AA either. All I would have told you is that I just needed some time to sober up, and then I would feel better, and I wouldn't feel compelled to drink like that anymore. You know what I mean? And I could remanage my life. I had just gotten I had gotten to a point where my life was untenable, and I needed to, like, get reset. Which, you know, if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, that's not the way it works. I found out through many, 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 many failed attempts. So, you know, the parents' house basement lockdown sobriety didn't work. You know, I was drinking within 2 days, you know, probably the day of. I remember I was calling friends of mine to drop, like, liquor and other things off outside of the house in the middle of the night, and I would walk outside and get it and bring it inside. And I looked forward to it all day. That was the whole day. And just knowing that it was coming offered some relief. You know, before it even got there, I would feel, like, a little bit better. Just knowing it was en route. You know, like, when someone's bringing you something, if you're like me, I'm going to text you 85 times, you know, for so many updates. You know, how far are you? How far are you? How far are you? And so I got put into, you know, after, you know, drink it again and some more consequences, and my family kind of realizing this wasn't going to work, they put me in an outpatient program. And that outpatient was the first time I got directed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So they said, you need to go to, you know, two AA meetings a week or something. I can't remember. I don't even remember if I needed to get slip signed, but I needed to go. So I went purely to oblige, like, the program that I was in. And I remember going back to the meeting, to the outpatient, and they're asking me, you know, what did you think of the meeting? And I don't remember today, like, anything about the meetings that I went to, really. I know that I, you know, if the meeting started at 8, I showed up at 8:05, and I know that I probably left at 8:55. You know what I mean? And I remember when they asked me what I thought of it, I just said, I don't know, I don't like it. You know what I mean? My default excuse was that I didn't like it because they talked about God there. That's what I used to say. I'd be like, I don't like it. They talk about God there. I don't like that. I actually don't think I cared that you guys talked about God there, but it seemed like a really good excuse, like something I could get really righteous about. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I don't do that. I'll do the God thing. But I don't think I actually cared. I just didn't think I needed to be there, you know? And it was confusing to me. Like, if you're telling me I have a drinking problem and I drink too much, which is what I understood alcoholism to be, it's just a drinking problem only, why would I go somewhere and talk about drinking the entire time? Or my drinking problem. That was my understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous, was a bunch of people with drinking problems talking about drinking problems. It seemed like a nightmare. You know what I mean? If you're new, that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is, because that sounds like a terrible arrangement. So I didn't have any interest. And I really didn't want to be sober. I just wanted to be out of trouble, you know? I just wanted my life, like, kind of back together. I didn't want to be in trouble anymore. I didn't want people breathing down my neck. That's all I wanted. And if I had to go to these couple meetings here and there to appease people to get it, that's what I would do, and that was it. You know, and once it was over, it was over. And I got out of that. That outpatient program ended, and I was in there for a couple months, and I think I stayed sober for a couple of the months. They were also giving you medicine to make you not drink. And although I drank before the end of the program, because they were giving you Anabuse, if anyone's ever been on Anabuse, and I drank on the Anabuse, which is, no, it's not good if you've never done it. It's terrible. I got really sick. And then, you know, I got out of that outpatient program, and I did think to myself, like, okay, you know what I mean? It's been enough time. I must be normal now. You know what I mean? That was what I thought. I must be normal now. And I just went back to doing what I was doing. You know what I mean? Living the same way I was living, hanging with the same people, going to the same places, living the same life. And for me, I can't live the same life and just stay sober. It doesn't work like that for me. You know, knowing that I have a drinking problem is not a sufficient defense against drinking. It's not at all. So within a couple months, I was doing what I was doing again. You know what I mean? Drinking every single day, stealing out of my mother's purse. And I was, you know, at this point, well, fast, you know, this went on for another year and a half or two. So I was 23 or 24 at this point, 23. Grown man, stealing out of my mom's purse, stealing from my father, you know, stealing his tools and things like that and pawning them, you know, breaking into my friends' houses, stealing from them, hadn't had a girlfriend in God knows how long because it wasn't even important. Hadn't had a job, you know what I mean? Anything like that. So eventually, really what it was my life got to like an untenable point again. And I don't even remember the specific consequences because by that point, you know, it was no longer about like, oh, well, this time I got caught or I got in a car wreck or I got, you know, caught by the police or anything like that. It was just, I would get myself to a point where I felt so, like the book says, like the consequences piled up on me, they felt astonishingly difficult to solve. Like life in general would just get to this point where it felt so overwhelming. You know what I mean? I would just feel so alone and afraid. You know what I mean? And I would break. There would just come a day where I would break. And in that moment, I would ask for help, you know? And I did that again, and I got sent to a long-term inpatient treatment facility. In that facility, you know, they eventually like funneled you into a section where you were kind of in like a halfway house and you would go to outside meetings and you had to go to a meeting every day. And you had to get a sponsor. That was the first time where I ever even knew that there was more to Alcoholics Anonymous than just going to the meeting and like drinking the coffee and then leaving, you know? So I got introduced to what Alcoholics Anonymous really was. And the facility was in Florida, so I was living in Florida. I eventually got out of the actual treatment facility and just, you know, rented a house with some of the friends I had made down there, like in the treatment facility down there in Florida. I was going to meetings here and there. I had a sponsor in name only, you know. And I worked some of this. I did a fourth step with that sponsor, I believe. So I did a fourth and a fifth step. I worked the steps. But I never believed that I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous because I needed to be there. You know what I mean? I was there until. You know what I mean? There was always an until. I'm here until I get this back. Or I'm here until I feel this good. You know? And what would always happen is, you know, if you're like me, and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while, and you do even some of the stuff that's suggested here. For me, I get stuff back in my life. My life gets better, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous works in that way. Like, it improves my life a little bit. I mean, the life was so terrible before. It's all relative. It doesn't take a lot. But my life would get a little better. I get some food in my stomach. I'd find somewhere to live. I have some friends now, you know, so on and so forth. I even got, like, a girlfriend. I got a dog, and I was like, you know what I mean? I got all these things, you know what I mean? Like, look at all the things that I got is how I would think about it. Look what I did. And then that's the first thought. I'm like, well, I have all these things now, you know what I mean? I can't be going to that many meetings anymore, you know what I mean? I just don't have the time, you know what I mean? Or, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I don't think I need to do that. You know, someone make a suggestion and be like, I'm doing pretty well, man. I got a dog. So, you know, I got my life together. Thank you. And then, you know, that's the first thought. That's like the first step out of the rooms. You know what I mean? Once I start thinking that I'm doing this, you know what I mean, on my own, that means that, if I'm doing it on my own, why am I coming here with you people? You know what I mean? I don't even like you all that much, you know? So that's the first step. Then I could probably do this by myself. And then I'm gone. That thought had crept into my mind, you know, months before I actually took a drink, was that, you know what I mean, I probably don't need to do, you know, my sponsor had started to give me suggestions, and I just pick and chose, you know what I mean? Some of them I did, some of them seemed annoying or inconvenient, I didn't do. So I was on my way out long before it actually happened. Eventually, like, it just got so uncomfortable being here around you guys when I clearly didn't want to be here. And I left. And I drank a couple times. There were a few catastrophes, but I thought I could hold it together on my own. I moved out of Florida. I moved back up here. I drank the way I wanted to drink, you know. And I got what I always got, but I thought that I had an idea of how to fix it. I thought, I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what they do there. I know the deal. I got this. You know, I can handle this. The problem is that what I don't understand is that what I didn't understand then is that drinking is not, you know, drinking is a problem. You know, I'm a problematic drinker. I get in trouble. I have problems when I drink. But the real problem for me is that sobriety, to be sober, is unbearable. It's unbearable, right? That's that feeling of mild dissatisfaction crept back into my life when I left Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed sober for a little bit, not going to AA, not working a program, but not drinking. But that feeling slowly crept back into my life. Like, life just wasn't enough. I was just never getting what I needed. And I thought that I just needed to do something different in life. Like, I need to move. I need to, like, pursue some different cause. I need to, like, you know, I was like, oh, I've been to AA. They talk about God. Maybe I need to get spiritual. I need to do something. So during that period of time, I did a lot of weird stuff. Like, I got real into yoga for a period of time. I thought I just need to eat really healthy and do a lot of yoga. I moved to a Buddhist monastery in California and, like, lived at this Buddhist monastery and worked construction there for, like, 4 months. It was beautiful, but I was insane. I would, like, hike. It was 2 hours from the nearest town, and I would, like, hitchhike out to go to the nearest town just to drink. Or I would call my friends and try to get them to mail me, like, illicit substances in the mail to a Buddhist monastery. You know what I mean? I was insane. There was a period of time where I tried every idea I had to, get that sense of relief, you know, some other way. You know what I mean? Basically, I thought I could, you know, I'll say at this point, I would acknowledge that I was I didn't know what it meant, but I would say I was an alcoholic. You know what I mean? I'd come to the point where I'd said, I'm an alcoholic. I could acknowledge I don't drink the same way that other people drink. Clearly something different is happening. I had so many failed attempts at drinking, and I watched so many friends of mine who drank just like I drank for so many years somehow suddenly get it together. You know what I mean? I know today that the book does a really good job of describing it. What those friends are is hard drinkers. You know what I mean? They drink. It looks just like a damn alcoholic sometimes. You know what I mean? They drink to get drunk. They get in trouble. They might be by my side the entire time. We can go drink for drink, get in the same jackpots, all the same stuff. But at some point in their life, there will come either a consequence or something positive or something happens where they say, whoa, I gotta get this under control, and they can do it. I waited for that moment for so many years. Like, I thought that moment would come where one morning I would wake up and have this motivation that I just had never had before to get it together. And I waited and I waited, and I kept thinking, okay, it'll happen when I get this job, then I'll suddenly be motivated. Or it'll happen, you know, when I move back here, then I'll suddenly be motivated. I kept trying to arrange my life in a way that would, like, make this motivation happen artificially. And then I just started thinking to myself, I would put, like, weird ages on it, like 27. 27 is the age when people get it together. You know what I mean? That's like the adult age. Up till then, it's fine. But 27 is probably the time. I legit thought that's how adulthood worked. Like, you just went really hard up to a point, and then all of a sudden you, like, woke up and got it together. Like, I'm going to pay some bills today. And then, like, woke up and paid all your bills. Like, that's how I thought it worked. Which is not how it works, by the way. And so, you know, that moment never came for me. And I was 26 years old, right? I was living back in my parents' house, back from that monastery, drinking the way I like to drink every single day, driving out into the fields in Laytonsville, Maryland. I would park my car, and I would sit there alone, and I would drink, and I would smoke cigarettes every day, and I would drive back to my parents' house. At this point, for years, I could convince myself that right around the corner, it was going to get better. You know what I mean? I was one day away from turning this ship around. You know what I mean? Every day I was like, oh, tomorrow's the day. Tomorrow was the day I was getting sober for 5 years, you know? But I believed it for years. You know what I mean? For years I could picture, like, my future. Even though it was delusional, I could be like, oh, one day I could see myself, like, married, having a job. I could picture it. By this point, I was 26, driving in that field, drinking every day. That was gone, man. I couldn't picture anything. You know what I mean? Anytime I thought about my future, all I pictured was, like, the same thing happening over and over again. Or I pictured myself dead or in jail. You know what I mean? The ability to, like, lie to myself about, you know, the delusion was gone that it was going to get fun again, really. And one day I was just driving back from the field back to my parents' house. And I was the perfect amount of, like, drunk and high, where I felt very smart, witty, and insightful, and I thought, I should call somebody. Probably talk to somebody. I probably got some hilarious, intelligent things to say. Need to get on the phone. So I picked up my phone and went into my recent calls to call somebody, and there wasn't a single person I could think to call. Not one. I didn't have a single friend I could call. The only people in my recent call logs were, like, an old drug dealer and, like, some missed calls from my mom, and that was it. And in that moment, like, the delusion that it was just about to get better wasn't there. It was gone. And in that moment, I felt, like, just absolute loneliness, you know? Like I said, I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous from jail, hospitals, treatment centers, all that stuff. A lot of, you know, consequences, you know, typical consequences that you hear about in AA. But what really, like, brought me to my knees was, like, that absolute loneliness, that alcoholic loneliness. And it was also the first time where that thought came, and I didn't have an immediate response. Like, oh, well, you can just do this. I didn't have my own idea ready to go. And it was the first time that would have been the case. So, a day later, I dragged myself back into a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to meetings for that entire week. And at the end of the week, I thought to myself, if you don't do something different this time, you know, you're going to die. And that night, I just picked a random meeting out of the where and when because it was close to my parents' house. And I walked into that meeting, and the last guy who shared seemed happy. So I walked up to him after the meeting and just said, I don't know what I'm doing, which is the first time I've ever said that, and I need some help. And that guy's been my sponsor from that day to this, and has saved my life. And I thank God that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, in the state I did, which was totally exhausted, just tired, man. There's no better way to describe it than tired. Like, and it was the first time I'd ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, really just without any of my own ideas, like, in tow. Because my experience is that alcohol, you know, staying sober, it's not easy, but it's not complicated. You know what I mean? It's not a complicated program. If I can listen to somebody else unconditionally, I got a pretty good shot. You know what I mean? That's really the primary requirement here, and I can be honest with that person. If I can do that, I got a pretty good shot. and this was the first time that I came here beaten to such a point that I would say, I just don't know, just tell me what to do. You know what I mean? Just tell me what to do. I don't even know what to do anymore. And he did. You know, that night he told me the meeting that he was going to the next night, and he said he'd pick me up at a time that turned out to be like an hour before the meeting started, which was mind-blowing why we were going that early. But we went that early, and he introduced me to some people that night, some other guys he sponsored, some friends of his, and he said, these guys are going to be taking you home. And I got in the car with those guys. I was 26 at the time, and the guys I was in the car with were a bunch of 19-year-old idiots. And I remember sitting in the back of the car that night being like, this is it. This is where your life is, man. This is how it's going to end. And I got dropped off by a bunch of 19-year-olds at my mom's house. And I thought, this is awesome. But I will say that, like, those first two nights, you know, are really like, you know, my first three steps in a way. You know, because that exhausted, like, beaten down surrender to ask that guy for help after that meeting was really a first step, you know. But a first step doesn't mean anything if I don't do, you know, if I don't respond to it by taking the actions that's suggested, you know. So he said he'd be at this meeting the next night, or he was going to go to this meeting the next night, he'd pick me up and to call him tomorrow to make a specific plan. And I called him the next day, and he picked me up. So that's really my first step, you know what I mean? Like, why would I do that? Why would I call this guy I'd never met to come pick me up, you know, at my mom's house to go to some weird meeting I'd never been to unless I was really just beaten, you know what I mean? Unless I believed that I was powerless. I wouldn't do that. And then, you know, when he said, you know, these guys right here are going to take you home, and, you know, this is him, get their phone numbers, call them, they'll call you. You know, I took that suggestion too. And, you know, like I said, I was in the car with those guys, and I was like, this is it, these guys are going to be my friends. But, you know, I did, looking back now, I did feel a sense of peace and ease because I had a thought, like, if it's working for these guys, like, these guys seem okay. Like, on that ride home, they were joking. I can't even tell the jokes that were going on in that car that night. It was hilarious. I was right up. I was down. It was hilarious. But I was like, if these guys are better and happy and joking, maybe, you know what I mean? Maybe this could happen. And that was, like, looking back now, that's a second step for me right there. The belief that I could get the same thing out of this program that these guys could get. And then, you know, my third step was really just continuing to be willing to take the suggestions that my sponsor was giving me, even when I thought they were stupid or inconvenient or, like, uncomfortable. You know, like, you know, after a meeting, if people ask you if you want to go hang out. Like, that was a brutal suggestion to take for me. I'd be like, oh, man, really? That seems like an absolute nightmare. Like, I drove. I still had my driver's license. And I was like, I had a car. Well, my parents had a car, which they were nice enough to let me drive from time to time, that I drove when I was new. So I would, like, drive myself to the meeting so I could leave whenever I wanted. You know what I mean? Control my own day. I got direction to not – I couldn't drive. I wasn't allowed to drive to meetings for the first couple weeks. I had to get rides so that I would be forced to spend time with people. And I took that suggestion, and I hated it because it was just uncomfortable. You know what I mean? Like, that car ride – you know, with someone you don't know, it's like a nightmare. You know what I mean? It was a nightmare. But I took that suggestion. And to me, like, that's turning my will and my life over to something other than me. You know what I mean? At the time, it was my sponsor, but it was a bigger idea in general. So that was, like, the first kind of sense of a third step. And it was the first time that I was ever willing. You know, because I'd been to coming to AA in some form or fashion for 6 years before this. But this was the first time that I would take those suggestions, even when my first reaction was, no, that's stupid, I'm not going to do that. But I would still do it. And in the end, those suggestions that I hated the most, like getting in the car with those guys or hanging out after the meetings, have yielded the greatest results. Those are the things that have improved the quality of my life more than anything. Those guys that he pointed to at that meeting, that he said, these guys are going to take you home, that second meeting I went to with them, two of those guys are my best friends today. You know what I mean? They were in my wedding, you know? And then the biggest, real indicator of a third step for me was doing the fourth step. Because, you know, the biggest, it's an indicator of the first, second, and third step, doing that fourth step. Because I like, one of my favorite readings is in the 12 and 12, it's the first step, and it's like the last paragraph in the first step in the 12 and 12. It says, like, who would care to do these things that we do here? You know what I mean? Who would care to, like, inconvenience themselves in this way, to like, reveal our secrets and our resentments, you know what I mean? To go to people we've harmed, to make, who would do this, you know what I mean? All the things we do here, on the surface, like, if I explained it to a normal person, they'd be like, that sounds really lame, man. Like, what'd you do last night? Like, oh, I went to this church basement, I set up a bunch of, like, you know, old rickety steel chairs, and then I made some, like, mediocre coffee, you know. I talked to people about nothing for a series of hours, and then when I went home, it was an awesome night. You know, who would care to do these things unless I, like, really, truly believed that I had to do these things or else I was going to die? You know what I mean? And so, you know, the fourth step was not my idea. I'm going to tell you that. I would never have sat alone in my room when drinking and thought, you know what would turn my life around? I need to, like, list all the people that I'm resentful at. And then I need to say probably why it's probably my fault. You know what I mean? And then I need to write, like, all the things I'm afraid of on a separate list. And then on a third list, it would probably be helpful to me if I wrote down all the weird sex stuff that I got into. And that'll probably change my life. That would never be my own idea, you know? So I took that suggestion, and I did my fourth step. And I'll say this. I had done, like I said, I've been Tay, and, you know, for years before this period of time. And I'd done four steps before. The fourth step I did with my sponsor during this period of sobriety was, I think, the fourth time that I'd done a fourth and a fifth step. And the other ones that I did were not, you know, glaringly different. You could lay them out next to one another, and you really wouldn't know the difference. Because I was so numb when I got here, just so numb, that I had no attachment to the way I was. So I wasn't even afraid to say anything, because I was so numb, it just felt like a different person anyway. A lot of people have different experiences than that, where they feel very raw when they're new. I was so numb. But I will say, you know, looking back now, there's one very obvious difference and another kind of less obvious difference in the way this fourth and the fifth step was this time. Was one was that there was one thing that I never mentioned on any of the previous four steps or in any of my previous fifth steps. I never said it. And I didn't even write it down when I did the fourth step this time. But we finished, and he asked, is there anything else? And I sat there silent for like 30 seconds to a minute, and then I told him, right? And he was like, all right, cool. And we moved on. Wasn't a big deal at all. Like it's really not even a big deal. And I don't know if that one thing is like the thing that didn't keep me sober the other time. I don't know. But I know that I did it this time, and I'm still sober. And the thing isn't even that big a deal. It's not like a huge – I'm not going to tell you what it is now, but it's not a huge deal. And, you know, I didn't walk out of that room after doing that fifth step and feel like walking hand in hand with my creator or anything like that. Like I said, I was pretty numb. But what I did feel like was that I was a part of now. You know what I mean? I felt closer to my sponsor, for one. And I felt like I was a part of. Like, when I went to a meeting the next night, I felt like it was our meeting. It wasn't your meeting that I was going to. It was our meeting. I was a part of this thing we were doing. And I started to feel like I started to feel a part of this thing. You know what I mean? And I wanted to be a part of this thing. I had felt like, you know, I had felt just like the tip of the iceberg of what was available here. You know what I mean? And I wanted more of it. And you know, so I was in 6 and 7, which is a period of time where I basically do all the things that were listed in my fourth step while sober and get really sick and tired of the way I'm living and all my defects until I get so tired that I say to God, oh, my God, please help me change. And that's like what 6 and 7 were for me. You know what I mean? It doesn't end. It wasn't like a period of time where I was in 6 and 7, then I was done, and now I'm not anymore. It's an all-time thing. Like, for me, 6 and 7, in retrospect, was that point where, you know, for the first 5 steps, I was basically trying to not drink anymore. You know, that's like what I'm doing. Like, help me not drink anymore. That's all I want. You know what I mean? I just don't want my old life anymore. Help me. And then there came, and in 6 and 7 is kind of like, you know, the transition sneaks up on me, but it's like, this is the time now where it's no longer about just not drinking anymore. It's about learning to live in a way where I don't ever feel the need to drink. You know what I mean? Because I'm not living in that selfish, self-centered, dishonest way that, like, that makes me need to drink to be okay with the way I'm living. And so 6 and 7 is constant. You know what I mean? It's just the willingness to kind of be honest with my sponsor and work through things when they come up. I didn't, like, say the 7-step prayer, and now I don't lie anymore. You know what I mean? I lied to my wife yesterday. I'm sure I lied to her today, and I don't even remember. But, you know, it's just – it's a constant thing that, you know, I try to maintain accountability with the people in my life, and that's the way I kind of work through 6 and 7, you know. And I really needed to start to change in order to go through and do 8 and 9 and start to make some amends and repair the relationships in my life. And I'll say this, you know, the greatest gifts I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous are the repaired relationships that I have today. You know, like I said, my brother's one of my best friends. He was the best man at my wedding. You know, I talk to my sister all the time. I love her to death, you know. I work with my dad, you know, every day. My dad and I work together. It was a real gamble, but it's one of the greatest gifts in my life because I see my dad as a person. You know what I mean? He's one of my best friends today. And my mom lives, you know, a couple miles from me, for better or worse. And, you know, I have 2 little kids, and my mom's there begging to come over and see my kids all the time. And she's at the house with my wife and with me and my kids, you know, on a weekly basis. And it's the greatest gift in my life. Second only to what's, you know, encouraged in basically steps 10, 11, and 12, which is that I have the privilege to be involved in the lives of other alcoholics, you know what I mean, and to sit with other men in Alcoholics Anonymous and basically tell them the experience that I had and say, you know, if you want it, it's available to you too. And I get to, you know, sit by and watch that happen for people, man, which is awesome. It's the greatest thing in the world. Which I never would have told you before I got here. And sometimes it doesn't feel like the greatest thing in the world. A lot of the guys I sponsor sometimes are just annoying, you know. But sometimes, like, I get to watch good things happen in their life and watch them change before they even realize they've changed. And it's just super cool. It's just really cool. And I will say, you know, the guys I sponsor have saved my life and, like, on numerous occasions, you know what I mean? And mean, like, they're some of my best friends today. You know what I mean? The guy I came down here with today is a guy I sponsored. He's one of my best friends today. Like, the guys I sponsor are some of my best friends. So it's really, it's a gift, man. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I hope that I always feel that way. I hope I always surround myself with people in AA who encourage me to keep doing the things that are suggested here. And I hope I always maintain a willingness to do them because I've, you know, I've only been here for this long, and I, you know, I believe that it can get better, because I've seen it get better for people. So, you know, I'm very grateful, and I'm grateful if you guys for having me out. So thanks so much for letting me share. Yeah.